Get out of here. Way back, hooks up. There's the cycle. You can't put it on the board. Yes!
A single, double, triple, and home run in one game.
He has hit for the cycle.
All right, welcome back to the cycle. We are recording at Guaranteed Rate Field. We have a guest via Skype today. We're very excited about this. The White Sox Director of Amateur Scouting, Nick Hostetler, is joining us. Nick, how are you?
Good. How you guys doing?
We're doing great. I'm here with Kevin Bozeman, and we were just talking about the draft and how you just scouted Louisville.
And Louisville and South Carolina, my man. You go back and forth.
Exactly right. Yeah, I mean, Louisville's about an hour and a half from my house, so that was smart. And South Carolina, they came to Kentucky at some point. It's about an hour from my house. So, I mean, why leave home?
So where do you live?
I live in Hebron, Kentucky, which is right next to the Cincinnati airport.
Perfect, right? And you've been with the White Sox. You had two stretches. You were here in 2001. Then you went to the Braves for a short time and been with the White Sox since 2007. You were named the Director of Amateur Scouting last year, or 2015. And last year was your first draft. Made a big splash with Zach Collins, Zach Birdie, another Louisville guy.
Yeah.
Alec Hansen.
Stay in your wheelhouse, Nick. Stay in your wheelhouse.
No doubt. Hey, why get out of my comfort zone?
Yeah, right. What about this year's draft? Because you had the number 10 pick 2 years in a row. We want to talk about what you were leading up to going to this pick this year.
Yeah, I think that coming off of last year, we wanted to make sure that we kept the momentum going. And it was something that I know myself and the rest of our staff was pretty excited after last year's draft. And obviously, it makes it a little bit easier when those guys go out and have success like they did. And coming into this year, we knew it was going to be a little bit different challenge without that extra pick in the first round like we had last year, and our picks are going to be spaced out a little bit more. But it was a different type of process this year than what we were last year, just because I think last year for me it was all new. It was the anticipation, the lead up, the excitement was all great, but this year it was a little bit more. I don't know if grueling is the right word, but it was a little bit more of a struggle in terms of trying to line some stuff up just because of the way the prospects were this year. It just wasn't a terrific year for superstar impact, but it was a really good year for depth. So it ended up working out great, and I couldn't have been happier with the way things eventually played out for us.
So you mentioned the word grueling. So the NBA has two rounds. You guys have 40 rounds? I mean, how grueling is that? How many people do you have on your team? How much time do you have to put into scouting and evaluating that many players to have 40, to go 40 rounds deep into a draft?
Yeah, we've got 25 full-time scouts that handled nothing but the draft. And the crazy part is we just finished the draft day. The last day of the draft was the 14th. And on the 16th, we started our draft prep for 2018. So it starts right away. It's a year long process, and trying to get to all these players and siphoning through all these different reports and dealing with a bunch of different personalities that I have on my staff, and including my own. Some of the stuff I do is a little crazy out there, but it can reach a point, usually January when stuff starts kicking off and full swing, you got the excitement, that adrenaline's going. By about March Madness time and that part of March, you're ready to just are we there yet? Is it over? Because you've reached a point where it's I don't know if I can watch another baseball game. You kind of catch that second wind, you get going.
How many guys are in that room the night of the draft? Just kind of take us in that room. What's the atmosphere like?
Yeah.
And who speaks? Who's allowed to chime in? Do you have to raise your hand? How's it all work?
Sometimes I wish we did. I wish we had those buzzers that guys would have to buzzer in, and it might eliminate some arguments and guys talking over everybody. But this was the first year we had part of our area scouts in. So we had those 10 guys. On top of that, we had 9 different supervisors let's see, 1, 2, 3. We had 4 of our analytics department, our player development department. We had 3 or 4 of those guys. And then obviously with Kenny, Rick, and Jerry, who ultimately they're allowed to do whatever they want in that room, they can, they're in there as well. So, you know, we had upwards of probably 25 to 30 guys in that room. And a lot of times it'll get a little bit out of hand and you gotta rein guys back in. But for the most part, it's pretty productive. There's not too many crazy stories that come out of it. You know, it's other than the pizza boxes laying around and all that stuff, that's about the craziest that we get on draft night.
But you have, like Kevin was saying, 40 rounds, and there's no way one person can be an expert on all of them. But you, it is your responsibility to know these, in this case, 40 picks, and know that, you know, be able to convey to Rick and Kenny, like, who these guys are and what they're all about. And do you have to do that do you have to do that in, like, a, you know, like an elevator pitch almost? Or how much time do you spend?
Guys, I got a guy in Louisville and I got a guy in South Carolina. You got to check these guys out.
I tried to do it quick for him, so that's why we drafted 6 guys from those 2 schools. But, you know, the one thing good about both Kenny and Rick is they're very gracious with their time. They're willing to sit and listen to me. I wear them out throughout the year. They hear from me too much, probably too many emails. Probably don't read half the stuff I send, which I don't blame them. I probably wouldn't either.
Are you forwarding a bunch of stuff?
No, I actually, like, I'll write it myself, but they probably don't read it, which I'm not sure. I blame them. But my staff, what they do is kind of how it works is our area scouts will see the players, they'll write the reports, turn them in. It'll go to our regional guys who then will go out, see the players that our area guys like, and then they send those guys to me, and then I'll go out and see those guys. And, you know, trying to go through all the reports, trying to make sure that I'm up to date on the players that we're picking. You know, and a lot of times, once we get in about around 15 and on, for the most part, I haven't seen those players. So it's our regional scouts and our area scouts are the ones that have seen them the most, and they're selling them to me, and we're making a pick, and then I have to kind of relay to Kenny and Rick who we're spending the money on. So it's a cool process. It's neat, and there's a lot of communication that's involved with it.
There's a lot of trust that has to happen then for that. Like if you're you go 15 deep in it afterwards, you're just putting a lot of trust in your regional scouts.
Exactly. And I, you know, those guys, I talk to those guys more than my wife, and which is bad for them, probably good for my wife. But we have to trust each other, because if we don't, and, you know, and I can't fully trust what they're putting down on paper being legit and the truth and their opinion, it's never going to work. And then it goes flip where Kenny and Rick have to trust me that, you know, they only really see the first pick. After that, they don't see any of them. So I've got to be able to make sure that I'm showing them that we're able to do the job.
So last year's draft, I want to talk about that for a minute, because this is a time where you became the director of scouting at a pretty cool time, because the White Sox are very open about the rebuild, and White Sox fans now know the name of the director of scouting probably more than they have in the past. They're paying attention to what players are in the system and how they're doing. I mean, in Chicago here, the minor league affiliates are getting so much attention. You know, Comcast did a special on these guys in Charlotte. But I want to talk about Zach Collins, Zach Birdie, Al Hansen, those guys. After you draft them, they're put in the system and they're having some early success. Do you still keep an eye on them or talk about them, or guys asking you questions about them, or you're done with that part and now you're moving on to looking at to add?
Probably for my health and my mental well-being, I wish it would be better if I could just move on. I can't. I follow every box score. I follow every at bat. Chris Getz is tired of talking to me, asking questions on, you know, why is the guy doing this, or is he doing this? You know, how does this guy look, or what do you think of this? And Buddy Bell and I talk often about it, and it just, they become, you know, and it's crazy to say it like this. I have 3 kids of my own, but each guy that we draft and sign, they somewhat become your own kid. I mean, you're rooting for them like your kid. You're defending them like they're your kid. If something goes wrong and they're playing bad or they get in some trouble off the field, you're always making excuses for them. And it's almost, it gets really weird because it's like I've added 40 more kids each year. And luckily I don't have to pay any pay anything out of my pocket for them.
Yeah.
And three of my owners are doing a good enough job.
And as if they're your kids, you drafted two Zachs back to back last year. That was confusing. You
yeah, that'd be a little weird. That'd be a little weird, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Is there anything to the rumor, like staying away from prospects with blue eyes because of their vision problems with the sun? Is that a real thing?
No, you know what? It's funny you bring that up because Rick Hahn and I were having a discussion this year about some of those things, the past scouts, the old time scouts, and one of them was the blue eyes with the sun. One of them was red haired, you know, kids that are red haired, rosy cheeks. If a kid's got an ugly girlfriend, that means he doesn't have confidence. I mean, the stuff that has been said.
That's true, though.
He's
also will be loyal to your team, too.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, it's funny because they said those things, and you know, and I sit there and I'm like, man, Mark McGwire had red hair. I'm cool with if Zach Collins turns into hitting 600 home runs. Like, you know,
right.
Those types of things. Like, you hear them and you try to not, you know, really put a whole lot of stock into them. At least I don't. I think they're actually kind of funny. And some of the guys that we see that you'll see it, and it's like, oh, he's got those rosy cheeks. And usually guys are using them as an excuse that they don't like them rather than trying to debunk the stereotype.
You must have seen scouting evolve so much since you started, especially with the rise of the analytics and everything. How do you balance all that out? And just talk to us about, let's pick one of these guys that you selected early, Jake Berger, Gavin Sheets, or Luis Gonzalez. Talk about what you liked about them, what you saw that made you think that they would fit with the White Sox.
Yeah, you know, and it has. The scouting has changed a lot when I first started. And when I started with the Braves, I mean, it wasn't discussed. We didn't even discuss the stats. And now, I mean, it's an integral part of what we're doing. And I'll be quite honest with you, the statistics that we're breaking down, that our analytics department is breaking down, they're so far beyond my thought process that, I mean, stuff has to be color-coded for me. Red is bad, green is good. So, but you know, in regards to guys like Zach, well, like last year, even with Zach Collins, but then this year, Jake Berger and Gavin Sheets and then Luis Gonzalez, they all had the ability to control the strike zone for us. And obviously when it jumps off the page and you see a guy that has more walks than strikeouts, but he's also showing power, that's not the norm. That's not what you normally see in big league ballparks. So when a guy shows you the ability to control the strike zone, but at the same time drive the ball out of the yard, and in Luis's case, you know, to play a true center field, be able to run like he is, you know, it's something that just adds to the bonus and the profile of the player, and ultimately what we think they're going to end up becoming.
I read somewhere in an interview that you did that you really enjoy the high school level and evaluating talent at that level. When did a guy like Jake Berger get on your radar? And then in addition to that, like who's like the youngest guy? You don't have to say the guy, but at what age do you start hearing about these guys?
Yeah, with Jake was a late bloomer. He was one that really didn't jump on the scene until his sophomore year of college. He wasn't a guy that went through a lot of the showcase events and a lot of the different things that most of these kids are doing nowadays. But so he came on a little bit late, but you know,
you just gave hope to a lot of our listeners that they think that they're late bloomers.
I'm still waiting on myself to bloom, and I'm 39 years old. But it's you know, with the probably the youngest guy that I really had ever, you know, been pitched to or seen play and jumped off the page was probably Bryce Harper. You know, we saw him.
How old was Bryce?
I think he was 15.
Wow.
Yeah, he was 15 years old, and he was in the area code games. And Justin Upton was another one, about the same age. And those two guys, like, they stood out. Like, they were playing against 18-year-olds, and they looked like they were the best. So, you know, those were probably the two that I can remember closest as being you know, that young and being that good.
So it's got to be difficult to really discover players because there's really no secrets anymore with the social media being what it is. And when you go to a game, do they know you're there? Like the players themselves, I'm sure the coaches do and things, but do you want them to know that you're there?
Yeah, you know, I don't mind it just from the standpoint of, you know, they're going to be playing in front of, you know, 20,000 people at a big league ballpark. I'd much rather to see how they handle pressure, you know, at 18, 19, 20 years old. You know, for the most part, if I go to a ballpark, there's going to be a lot of scouts there just with my role and the players as high up as I'm seeing, a lot of scouts are going to be there. Now, our area scouts, and back when I was an area scout, I can remember going to games where I'd be the only scout there. And sometimes you do want to blend in. You know, I've heard stories of area scouts hiding in center field or sitting in the setting up a lawn chair in a woods behind left field to try to see the player where nobody could see is there. So,
that's creepy.
I mean, there's stories like that. It's really creepy. So, trust me, a lot of the stuff we do, body comparisons and stuff like that, it's really creepy. It's not something that I think we should be very proud of that. But they do sit in the, you know, you'll have guys that will try to hide out some stuff and all that. But with social media and the way stuff is nowadays, the days of hiding players out and not going noticed are pretty much gone.
Have you ever had someone that you felt adamant about and fought really hard for and it ended up turning out to be a success, or one you fought really hard for and it just didn't pan out, and then everybody's like, we told you that this player was no good and you fought hard for him? Like, you have any stories about that?
Yeah, Kevin, that's pretty much exactly what every day for me. It's one of those deals where, you know, you find a guy and you're like, man, I love this guy. I think this guy's going to be a stud. I think he's going to be this, going to be that. And more than not, just the percentages, they don't happen. You know, they don't turn out to be what you thought they were going to. Oh, straight up, Jared Mitchell was one of them. I mean, Jared Mitchell, when I saw Jared Mitchell, I was like, man, this guy can do everything. For power, he can run, he can play the outfield. He's going to be a stud. And he never sees a major league game.
So you have no problems with throwing people under the bus right now.
Yeah, I threw Jared right under that, didn't I? And I guess...
Don't worry about it. We talked to him, and he was like, that creep used to watch me from the woods.
I was up with the develop, but I always got somebody watching me from the woods.
Yeah, I'll be straight up. I'll be under that bus with Jared, though, because I was one of the ones pushing me. But... a lot of that stuff happens, man. It's your opinion. And, you know, ultimately the White Sox are paying us, our scouts, for their opinion. And if I start going in and start killing a guy because he missed on a guy, or, hey man, you told me this guy was going to be this and he's not, what's the deal? You start doing that, you're going to lose the guy's willingness to give you his opinion. They're going to turn into survivors and just tell you what you want to hear. And that's not what I want. So ultimately, while we miss a lot, it happens a lot. And, you know, if all these guys end up big leaguers, if five guys end up big leaguers out of this draft, like, we had a great draft. So the percentages aren't in our favor, but I just want guys to stay consistent with it and give that opinion.
When you went to Missouri State or Wake Forest and saw Jake Berger or Gavin Sheets play, what are there restrictions on how much you can talk to them or what you can talk about?
Usually during the season, we don't, the college coaches doesn't, they don't usually like to give us access to their player, and understood, they're trying to win and their job's on the line. Usually a lot of times in the off season is when we have the most access. We can give players eye tests, psychological tests. We can meet with them individually, watch them work out, watch them practice, whatever it may be. And then usually right before the draft, a week or two before the draft, they'll kind of open it back up where you'll have specific days where you can come in and sit down with the player. And but during the season, when I go in like to watch a game, let's say Wake Forest is playing North Carolina, I won't talk to Gavin at all. You know, I went in, watched him play, and got out of there. I waited to do my meeting stuff and interview stuff until after his season was complete before the draft, in between the conference tournament and the NCAA.
You do the psychological test. Do players ever balk at that, or is it understood, hey, you got to do that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of them now are just taking what Major League Baseball gives. Back when I was with the Braves as an area scout, we had this test. It was called the PF-16 test, and it was just like your typical, look like an ACT bubble test. And everybody used to take it back then. But as the MLB Scouting Bureau has gotten more involved, they handle a lot of that stuff for us. So usually the player will only take one of those tests. And occasionally, if we have some concerns or questions, we might administer one of our own. But I think maybe we've done that two or three times in the last 5 years.
And is there any funny stories about what an old school scout or even somebody doing it now, they maybe told you like they like to look for or like to ask, and you were like, wow, I never thought of that, or that's ridiculous?
Yeah, you know, I go back to one of my first years scouting. There was a guy named Lamar North who since passed away. He was the area scout with the Baltimore Orioles in Georgia, and signed Willie Harris out of Kennesaw State. And it was my first year scouting, and Lamar was really good with taking young guys under his wing, but he was also really good at getting young guys to give him all their information. And he told me we were in Cairo, Georgia, and he asked me to meet him at a Hampton Inn. And I walked into his room in the Hampton Inn. He had a bottle of scotch there, poured us both a drink. He sat there and kind of started going, giving me what he asked players, and he was telling me all about. And at the time, I'm 22 years old maybe, and I'm taking all of this in, and he's telling me about asking them about what they do mostly off the field, how they spend their free time, just because most of these players are in school, so they're managing school time and playing. And once they have all this free time, what's going to happen? So, you know, he gave me a lot of that. By the end of the night, he gave me a lot of answers to ask, and he had my entire draft list. So he did a good job with that.
Wow.
With that bottle of liquor. So he knew what he was doing.
Oh, wow. That's your kryptonite, huh? What's your drink of choice?
Yeah, no, and the funny part is I think that's the last time I've ever had any of it. So
You learned.
Lamar taught me a lot that night.
What, so like as far as like, so I saw Trouble with the Curve, you know, the Clint Eastwood movie. How realistic is that on a scale of 1 to 10? Like that whole dialogue and stuff that the scouts have with the management and identifying players, because it seemed like really basic things that everyone would be able to pick on. They may seem like only Clint Eastwood could see this, and I'm like, no, everybody should be able to see that. Am I wrong with that, or is that?
I know exactly what you mean. It was really, you know, I got to be honest with you. Spending every day or 250 days out of the year with these guys, there isn't none of us that are Clint Eastwood, not one Justin Timberlake in the group. And if I even remotely sent Kenny or Rick or anybody to go see a player that looked like that guy that they were giving that first pick to, they would have killed me.
I know. That's why I was like, dude, who's drafting this dude in the first round? Like, who?
Exactly.
Yeah, I saw it, and I was like, this movie is so unbelievable to me. This can't be what the scouting process is like.
Yeah, get a guy that at least looks the part, and then at the same time, there isn't one of us that are going to be willing to stay in a hotel that looks like that. We're all Marriott's and Hilton's, and it ain't happening. But you know, I've never worked out the worker at the hotel's kid, and he becomes the left-handed pitcher. So, you know, all of it. There were actually a few scouts in that movie, a few area scouts that had. You could see them in the background of a few of the games, and it's kind of funny because we give them some crap about it. But you know.
Were you the consultant on this movie?
No, I was nowhere to be found.
No, I mean, do you give those the area scouts that was in that movie? Do you give them a hard time? You're like, dude, did you consult this movie? Did you see this?
Excuse me. Yeah, no, we still ride those guys. They're like, what were you guys thinking? And like, really? And they're like, hey, we got to meet Clint Eastwood. And I'm like, good point. But you know, I think that the one part of that movie that really hits home and it is legit. It's just the overall the grind the drive of it, you know, getting in the car and hitting the back roads and going in places where you never think you'd end up in your life to watch a baseball game. That
what's
part
the,
of it
was the weirdest place.
You're like a road comic, man.
Yeah, we can relate to that. We can definitely relate to that.
How do you get through when you are exhausted mentally? How do you get through a game? How do you get through a road trip?
You know, I think thinking about why we're doing it, and in all seriousness, it goes back to, you know, as a kid thinking that you're going to have an ability to work in a job that it's Major League Baseball. You know, you're being paid by a Major League Baseball team. You're an integral part of bringing in talent, and you can turn on the TV and watch that player that you drafted a few years ago hit a home run and win a game for you in Chicago. Those things, I know sometimes it sounds corny and cliche with it, but it's true. You know, you kind of sit there and you're like, man, another day, another airplane, another, you know, another car ride, another fast food meal, whatever it may be. You know, it's one of those things that you just sit there and you think, man, that, you know, what else would I want to do? Like, this is exactly what I want to do in my life.
Well, I've been a White Sox fan my whole life, and I can really only imagine how much satisfaction you must get out of seeing guys that you picked and you built and that came through the system and then have success in the big leagues. Because in the early 90s, when they had that great wave of so much talent that was homegrown, the homegrown guys that contributed in 05. I mean, it's like, you know, if you garden and you grow lettuce and vegetables in your yard, you bring it in the house, it tastes better than when you go pick up free agent lettuce at the store.
Right.
You know?
No one likes that. No one likes those whole food carrots.
Even the fan base. Even the fan base loves
food one.
Yeah, right. The fan base loves that. We love the homegrown, and this is an exciting time because there's so much of it going on right now.
It's such a great analogy because when you go out and get that, you're overpaying for it, chances are. Like just like Whole Foods, you're overpaying for those carrots.
Absolutely.
Where you just grow it naturally. You got them on the contract, you can develop them, and they stick around longer. Such
you can take
analogy.
That gardening analogy, Nick. It's yours now, man.
It's yours, but
you can run with that.
maybe you can use that on Trouble with the Curve, too.
It is, though. I mean, you guys hit it on the head. It is what it is. That's exactly what it is. And you're trying to, you want to make sure that you're having a thumbprint, your impact. And that's the only way that we're going to impact the organization, is by having our players come up and play well and play in the big leagues, or giving Rick assets so he can go out and trade for guys. And that's the only way that we're going to impact it. And ultimately, if we win another World Series and get another ring, you know, we want to put it on our finger knowing that we did something for it.
How much do you feel like about when guys are ready to go to the big leagues, or maybe like, hey, I know those guys and they're progressing well in the farm system, let's not rush them. Where are you at on that?
Yeah, you know, I try to stay out of that, mainly because, you know, Chris Getz, Buddy Bell, our minor league coaches, they're around those guys a lot more than what I am at this point. You know, I'll go in and see them. I'm headed to North Carolina tomorrow to watch Team USA, and I'll pop in and see Winston-Salem while I'm down there. And, you know, they'll ask, and we'll throw some ideas back and forth, but ultimately – you know, I want to stay out of that because I don't want to step on anybody's toes with that. If they ask me and they want my opinion, I'll be more than happy to give it. But, you know, those guys are around those guys every day. They're going to know a little bit better on how quickly to move some of these guys. And really, I'm excited from the rebuild standpoint because we can slow some of these guys down. We were notorious for rushing guys up there because we had to. And now we can slow these guys down and we can take it step by step, and we can let Alec Hansen have a great first half in Kannapolis before he moves to Winston-Salem, or have, you know, whoever, Zach Birdie doesn't have to come up and pitch in the big leagues last year. He can figure some stuff out and have some struggles in Charlotte and learn how to work out of them there rather than on TV every night. So those things I do think are valuable, and I am excited from a development standpoint that we actually have some time now to let these kids fail and learn how to fail.
I think the big difference between, I want you to elaborate on this, the big difference between like a baseball draft and other drafts, where like other drafts they draft for a need, where you guys are just constantly looking for the best talent available, correct? You're not drafting.
Correct.
Like, we got to get a third baseman in the first round. You are taking the best player available each round. You're not ever going, but we need a shortstop or we need an outfielder.
No.
If there's no shortstops to be drafted in that round, you can go 40 rounds without drafting one, correct?
Correct. And I think Tim Anderson, the year we took Tim Anderson, is a perfect example. I think before that, Ozzie Guillen was the last homegrown shortstop we'd had. So, I mean, for us, from Ozzie and Padres.
Really?
Yeah, he was drafted by the Padres. We traded for him when he was young, and then, you know, he's played, but Ozzie was like the last true, real shortstop, and it was like, you know, we, over that course of time, nobody ever felt the need that we had to go draft shortstops. And, you know, and at no point in that room, or any time that I've met with Rick or Kenny, Jeremy Haber, whoever it may be, on the side, have they ever told me, oh, we need this, so let's go get this. You know, and similar to Zach Collins last year, we didn't target Zach because he was a catcher. If anything, the catching part of it was secondary. We thought he could stay there, but it wasn't what everybody in the industry thought he couldn't catch. You know, and then with Jake Berger, everybody questions whether he's going to stay at third. It's primarily the offensive profile that both those players bring. And, you know, in our mix this year, we had a couple outfielders. We had a third baseman. We had a first baseman. We had a middle infielder. So, you know, we had pretty much everybody, every demographic kind of check, and it was, we had a pitcher, and it was just a matter of which guy we felt fit best in our organization and what guy we felt that, you know, was trying to, what could help us accomplish what we were trying to do. And that was to get guys that get on base, that cut down their strikeouts, and or pitchers that throw strikes and have premium stuff. So, yeah, no point have they ever told me to draft for a need, and I can't imagine at any point them ever doing that.
When you drafted a Larry King song, did somebody in the scout room be like, that guy's got a chance to be there for a long time? He's got some longevity. He's going to be.
I was hoping I could get through this one without that question coming up.
He's got a chance to be his organization for decades.
Well, I've answered more questions about this Chance King than I have Jake Berger, I think. Yeah, you know, we actually did have a scout that saw him. You know, Larry has a good relationship with Dennis Gilbert and Mr. Reinsdorf. And I think sometimes it's nice to do a family a little bit of a tip of the hat and somebody you're close with to help with one of their kids out. And that's what I'll stick to.
Hey,
Chance, Great Falls, Idaho. Go.
Yeah. What was Larry's thing? Hello, Great Falls, or something like that. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, that would be
But yeah, I'm not sure. I think Chance is going to end up going the college route. We'll see what Chance ends up in 3 years.
Is that the same thing applies for another under radar superstar name in the sports world? Tom Crean's son, Riley.
Tom Crean's son actually, and this isn't a knock on Chance at any point. Tom Crean's son was actually on our area code team last summer, and he's actually got a chance to be pretty good. Riley's got a really good curveball, and one of the things scouts in projecting what they're going to be in 5-6 years, whatever it may be, is trying to figure out what have we seen in the past that has told us a guy might throw harder? And one of the things is when his breaking ball is about 78 miles an hour, and when they throw a curveball that hard, it tells us that they've got some arm speed there. So we think that over time, as they physically develop, they're going to throw harder. Riley was an upper 80s guy that had a breaking ball and that was like that. And we actually think Riley's got a chance to be something in 4 or 5 years. He's going to go to school. I think he's going to IMG, the same route that the kid that Cleveland took, Brady Aiken, that was the first pick overall a few years ago, the same route he did. But he's going to go there. But he actually has some ability to him.
How old do you think you should be when you start throwing breaking balls?
Speaking from someone that's had 3 shoulder surgeries, I started throwing them at 12. I would probably say, personally, I would love to see 15. I think I go back to, you watch all these kids in these Little League World Series that are throwing all these breaking balls at 12 years old. I can't name you a pitcher that's come out of the Little League World, that's pitched in the Little League World Series and has ever become anything. I can't think of one. It's all hitters. It's Todd Frazier. It's Gary Sheffield, guys like that. But pitchers, they just, you know, you start throwing curveballs at 12 years old, nothing good's going to happen with that.
So when you say you So you drive a kid out of high school, and they're going to college. Like, how long do you guys own their rights?
We only own their rights until July. I think this year is like July 10th, something like that. And then in the past, years past, if a kid would go to a JUCO, we controlled their rights for one full calendar year. They did away with that. Now there's no longer any draft and follow, so we only have until July. But there are some times where we'll take a couple high school guys that, one, we know we aren't going to sign. Two, we think that can get better over the course of 3 or 4 years, and primarily just to get to know the kid better. And we might have some spots where we don't need to fill. You know, we have our rosters filled at Great Falls in Arizona, so we don't need any more players to sign. We might take some high school guys just to get to know them better. And, when we draft them, it might give us a little bit of an in 3 years later.
So you'll draft them and then possibly redraft them?
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. You have signed.
Happens often.
You've signed the top three picks at this point, correct?
Yeah, I think Gavin Sheets is in Chicago. Possibly, I think it's today to do his physical and all that, so he should be done in the next 48 hours. But
now,
for all three of those guys. Man.
Gavin's father had a nice career in the major leagues, correct? Larry Sheets?
He did.
Does that?
Yeah, Larry had a...
You like that about him?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it kind of helps the learning curve for him. He knows what he's getting himself into, and Gavin understands. You know, he understands the clubhouse. He understands how all that stuff works, how big league baseball is, how, you know, the grind of it, the fighting through an 0 for 20 and stuff like that. So, it can only help him when he gets out.
Whereas Chance King only understands running a show for 30 years and marrying six different women. Not to say he's going to do that. All right, hey, we're going to wrap it up with you, Nick, because I know you're a very busy guy. I want to ask you this, though. You've been all around the country. It's summer. People are going to be looking for things to do. People love baseball. Name some obscure parks that might be fun for people to visit.
One thing I could recommend everybody to do is go watch the Cape Cod Summer League for 4 or 5 days. I go up for 2 weeks every year in July, and I sit there and watch. There's games at 5 o'clock and at 7 o'clock. They're at small little high school fields, and it's the best college baseball in the country. It's great seafood. You've got great people, and the area is nice. The weather's terrific. And so one thing I think every baseball fan should do is go see some games in the Cape Cod Summer League.
That sounds cool. Are you able to travel with your family a little bit?
Occasionally they do go with me. This year they're not. My wife kind of has her own thing set up now where if I'm home, I screw it up. And when she starts going on the road with me, I screw up her daily routine there. So I'm going to watch my daughter play in a volleyball tournament next week in Minneapolis. And that's about the only travel we're going to have together this summer.
Well, good for you. Enjoy it, man. And Nick, great stuff this year. Everyone's excited about the draft. Everyone's excited about all the prospects that you are putting into the system. We wish you all the best, and we really appreciate you joining us on the cycle.
Yeah, Pat, Kevin, thanks so much, guys. I really enjoyed it.
All right, that's Nick Hostetler, the White Sox Director of Amateur Scouting. You could follow him on Twitter. I was checking out. You got some good stuff. You got some good tweets, man. Just give everybody your Twitter handle.
It's at Nick Hostetler. That's it, I think. I think that's my Twitter handle. I don't even know.
It is, I think. I love the draft day tweet. Everyone should check that one out. All right, good stuff. Thanks, Nick. Good luck to you, buddy.
All right, thanks, guys.
Take care.
He gone! He did it!